I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The House healthcare reform bill is limping toward a rare Saturday night vote as Democratic leaders scramble today to placate party members threatening to defect over contentious issues like abortion and immigration. Meanwhile, the AARP has thrown its support behind the bill, despite concerns from many seniors about the bill's proposed cuts in high-end Medicare coverage. Gail Shattuck has been following all of this. She's senior congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, let's start with abortion. About 40 Democrats have said they'd oppose the bill if public funds are used for abortions. Now, we've heard that the bill calls for the Secretary of Health and Human Services to decide if public insurance option money covers abortion. But also, we've heard that it calls for a separate account to hold premiums paid by users, and then abortion services would be paid for from that separate account, not from taxpayer money. So, what do we know is true about what the House is proposing?
We will know a lot more tomorrow about 2 in the afternoon when the Rules Committee takes up what's likely to be a very important amendment on abortion, where they try to nail down this language. And the language might be, yes, public option money might be used, but it has to be rigorously separated from abortion services. That is, the money that will fund the abortion directly will be the copay, or it will be a private premium. So the effort is to come up with an accounting device that will reassure opponents of abortion services that the public dollar will never touch the service.
Well, the Right to Life Committee says that moving money like that is just money laundering, you know, sleight of hand. But tell us more about these Democratic, in particular, opponents of abortion. In this political climate, there's an equation here. There's a magic number that Democrats have to come up with. What's going on behind the scenes?
Well, that number is 218. And if there are, in fact, 40 Democrats willing to buck leadership on this, and we have not seen a complete list of this yet, if there are 40 Democrats, that means the health bill fails. It will not make that 218 number. The speaker said today that the election in upstate New York gives her one more Democrat, and that will swing the number. We'll see.
And you say Democrats have been pretty shaken about the other votes in New Jersey and Virginia.
Those votes gave a bad momentum to this bill. That is, the suggestion that there is a groundswell out there of concern about what national Democrats are doing, perhaps what the president is doing, that could affect these vulnerable Democrats going into the 2010 election. So that's really the calculation.
So are Democratic leaders working to protect those 40 Democrats who might have fears about funding for abortions?
That's why the language of the amendment that comes up tomorrow is so important. Yeah. That is, Democrats need cover on this. Desperately. And the one proposal that's been made to date, which is to hire a private contractor to handle those payments, didn't go anywhere with these Democrats. So they're going to have to come up with something else, something stronger. We'll see what it is.
A couple other issues that are proving contentious. The current bill allows illegal immigrants to buy insurance in the so-called exchange set up by the government, but they will not be allowed to get any federal subsidies to help defray the cost.
Now, that, too, is a subject that is likely to be amended from the floor. We'll see how far it goes. The concern here is that you don't really solve the problem of, for example, all of the care that's going on in emergency rooms and then being passed on that hospitals can't afford. You don't solve that if you don't deal with all of the illegals that are showing up and getting services today. Republicans want to push harder on this. They want to make sure that even those who are in the country legally at this point perhaps don't receive coverage for 5 years.
Well, let's look at AARP. They infuriated Democrats by backing George W. Bush's Medicare drug program. Now they're infuriating Republicans by backing health reform. They offer a product that sells the high-end Medicare Advantage. It's assumed that a lot of the cuts are going to come in that high-end Medicare coverage. AARP says they don't mind cuts in waste because they say that's going to make the overall program stronger for seniors. But industry backers like the Galen Institute say AARP has a conflict of interest here. They want seniors to leave Medicare Advantage and purchase AARP's Medigap. So a lot of criticism of them here.
It's a real issue, and it'll fall out in terms of what their members do. We've been hearing that there have been members who are simply turning in their cards and carving them up because they have been alarmed by the magnitude of the cuts to Medicare.
And how much of that do we know is real? And how much of that is being manufactured by people against health care reform?
Well, I've tried to track that down. AARP has told me directly that it's just trivial, the number of cuts they're seeing. I haven't seen official numbers on that, and I think you wouldn't see the full impact until after the bill comes out.
Right.
But their endorsement today was a huge boost in momentum for this bill. I mean, it's the timing coming right after these tough elections, coming in the, you know, as you're seeing very difficult issues on abortion and illegal immigration.
Gail Chadwick, Senior Congressional Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks as always.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This week, the French government launched a debate over what it means to be French. Must you speak French? Can you wear a burqa? Well, this will all certainly sound familiar to our next guest. Michael Goldfarb has written a book that begins with a similar debate more than 200 years ago on the eve of the French Revolution. The question in 1785 was one that came up over and over again. It was the question of the Jews, or as one essay contest put it, are there means to render the Jews more useful and happy in France? Well, one way might have been to stop forcing them to pay a special poll tax whenever they entered a new town. Remember, this was 150 years before the Nazis, but Jews were still basically locked in ghettos, limited to their traditional occupations like rag picking or small-time money lending, and in some cases, in some countries, forced to wear a yellow star and referred to as Christ killers. The French Revolution changed everything, or as Michael says, one day we were completely segregated, the next day Napoleon comes along and tears down the ghetto gates and we can do anything we want. Well, sort of. His new book is Emancipation, How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. In it, he also wonders what this piece of history might teach us about segregated groups or immigrant populations today. And Michael Goldfarb, a former colleague, in fact, on occasion, former host of this very program, joins us in the studio. Michael, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Good to be here.
Good to see you. And give us some context for this piece of history. You start in the late 1700s, take us up to Hitler and pre-World War II, but where are we in the Age of Enlightenment, the Revolution?
Well, it's interesting. The Age of Enlightenment had reached its political phase from the theories about tolerance and reason as opposed to, you know, blind faith and so on. We got to the political phase, and in the French Revolution, people asked themselves before they rebelled, you know, what kind of society do we want to build? We know we have to build a new society.
And this is 1700s.
1785, 1787, then 1789 happens in the fall of the Bastille. You know, the real reformers, the future revolutionaries say liberty, equality, fraternity. Mm. All men are brothers. All men are equal. And the question they ask is, well, if all men are brothers, are you including the Jews?
You know, it reminded me so much in reading all of this and being reminded of this, of America post the American Revolution. Everybody's equal except those slaves.
There is actually a direct, I mean, there are many parallels, which is one of the reasons I chose the title Emancipation, which is, you know, in America that has a very specific meaning. But emancipation had been a word being used for 75 years prior to the Civil War around Europe. I mean, emancipation of Irishmen in the British Isles. I mean, the emancipation of the Jews in France. And, you know, look, the test case is what happened. I mean, there were 26 million people in France at that point. 40,000 were Jews. I mean, not even a half of 1%. And yet they had become, it kind of became a national obsession about how do we test our ideals and what's the test population? The Jews.
And you write that the hatred of the Jews was like the air that people breathed. It was just there. But remind us why, because we learn in your book that the word ghetto comes from a section in Venice that Jews were ordered to live in 1516. So why were they still in ghettos in the 1700s?
Well, actually, they were in ghettos from long before that. In fact, Venice is one of the last places to ghettoize their Jews. It started in the Black Death. You know, we caused it, not, but that was the view. It had just become a habit. But the other thing is that on the inside of the ghetto gates, you have to remember that, you know, the Jewish religion was kind of a monolith, and it withdrew in on itself. It had started to have more engagement going back in the 17th century, but it was in on itself, and so it just kind of
insular.
Pottered along. And, you know, what happened is, you know, And this is, I think, a point of relevance with today and the French going crazy every 3 months about, you know, young women going to school wearing a hijab or wearing niqab, which is the veil. You know, it's like You went, if you were a peasant and you were between planting and harvesting.
A French peasant, yeah.
You need to borrow a little money. So you go to this small guy who's got, he's wearing a caftan, he's got a beard.
He looks different.
He smells different because his diet is different. He barely speaks French. And when you look at the ledger, you can't read, but you know that what's written on the ledger about how much you owe is in some secret script because they wrote in Hebrew. And, you know, it was very alien. And so they said, this is a nation within the nation. They cannot possibly be French. And the elites in the Jewish community who did work for the government said, no. We're born on French soil. We are Frenchmen who happen to be Jewish.
And as you point out, it's different across the continent. I mean, Jews have different, slightly different experiences in different places, but it's sort of a chicken and egg question. Some perhaps were self-segregating and some were segregating because they were hated. So it's sort of, you know, it sort of becomes this vicious cycle. And then I'm really fast-forwarding here. The French Revolution does happen. It leads in part to the emancipation for the Jews. Then we come across the Reign of Terror in France. Out of that insane time comes Napoleon, who seizes power, marches across the continent, and liberates the Jews. I somehow miss that part of history.
Well, again, the Code Napoleon said, you know, rights of active citizenship should apply, liberty, equality, and fraternity to all members of society. When the first place he went on the march was in Italy, where there was very serious ghettoization. Most Jews actually lived in the countryside, so it was more like little self-segregated hamlets. You couldn't be in big towns after dark. He went, you know, he tore down ghetto gates. In Padua, he actually made the city fathers go to the ghetto, to the gates that were locked, forced them to remove the gates, drag them to the big piazza, and burn them. He then renamed the ghetto, the main street of the ghetto, Via Libera, you know, Via Freedom Street. And this happened all over Europe. And so from that moment, an amazing surge of integration, a desire to meet up. And there was a terrible price as well for doing that, because you have 500 years of tradition and insularity, and suddenly the Jewish religion is in conflict with kind of modern life. So Jewish religion had to be reformed. And in some ways, this is what's happening with Muslims in Europe today. I mean, you make a choice as a Muslim today. You know, will you be an Orthodox Muslim, or are you going to be so integrated that, you know, you're sort of outside your community?
So a lot of impact from emancipation. There's a reformation of the faith. There are also people who, they might be liberated, but it still isn't working. So you see a lot of Jews convert just to pass. And we also see this flowering. We suddenly, names just come, like flowers, spring up. Freud, Einstein, I can't even, Marx, Mendelssohn, Mahler. And we'll take a look at the flowering post the revolution, but also how the revolution might have freed Europe's Jews to decide to resegregate, re-self-segregate again, and lead to the birth of Israel. Michael Goldfarb, his new book is Emancipation, How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. We're going to have more of this fascinating look at history and also how it applies today after a quick break. Also later today, that medical marijuana growth in California, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now and to our conversation with Michael Goldfarb. His new book is Emancipation, How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. And you can read an excerpt of the book at our website, hereandnow.org. And also for listeners here in the Boston area, Michael's going to be reading from the book this evening. You can get information about that at the website as well. And Michael, we were talking about this flowering in the Jewish world that came after the French Revolution, and yet it wasn't without its complications. But before we get to that, the names that pour forth, I mean, almost immediately, Sigmund Freud, Albert Einstein, just all these people that were suddenly able to fulfill their promise outside the ghetto, and others that I had frankly never heard of and had these incredible contributions, you call them ghosts.
Yeah, well, that was not something I knew when I started researching the book. I mean, I was trying to figure out why there'd been the explosion, Marx, Freud, Einstein, Mahler, and everybody else. And then I started coming across these other names. And one of them was a guy named Gabriel Rieser, who in 1848, year of revolution in Europe, the German middle classes had called a parliament. They're going to try and create a unified Germany. Germany was not unified then. And they're going to write a constitution. And here's this guy. He was a lawyer. He had published a newspaper called Der Jude, the Jew, at a time when the Jewish community itself was trying to get everybody to call them the Israelites or the Hebrews. And, you know, he wrote this essay in which he said, "Don't you know the angel of death will find you through 1,000 good names?" Anyway, he seemed interesting. I have a friend who writes for Die Welt, Thomas Kielinger. I call Tom up. I say, "Tom, do you know who this guy is? He's German. He seems to be important." And Tom said, "I've never heard of him." And Tom thinks he knows a lot. Mm-hmm. But 2 weeks later, I get an email from him, and he says, "Michael, I'm very sorry. This man actually is very important, and I'm very surprised at myself that I don't know who he is." And I wrote back, and I said, "I understand why. The reason you don't know who he is that the community that would have remembered him no longer exists in Germany. It's either been murdered or everybody went away." And I kept coming across these people who have no one left in Europe to remember them, or they're reminders of a different time and people don't want to remember. And I suddenly found that I was a ghost hunter as well. And they became, in writing the book, to me as important as Marx, Freud, and Einstein. And in fact, you know, I've actually had one reviewer that took me to task saying, "Oh, you rushed through Marx, you know, Freud and Einstein." I said, "Why? There's 1,000 books on each, and they wrote about themselves. But nobody wrote about Gabriel Reiser.
Or Hess or Moses Hess, or
Heine is known but in this country, but only to, you know, German academics. And these are amazing men."
Well, and so what happened? I want you to collapse a lot of history now because we have this emancipation and this flowering. But this time also gave birth to the leaders of the Zionist movement and this idea of it isn't working as well. This is before, you know, we hear the drumbeat of the Nazis. In fact, we meet Adolf Hitler in your book as an art student. But what happened?
Well, there was always resistance to the idea of the social emancipation of Jews. And that was part of the tension. I mean, the whole reason I think there was this explosion of achievement was there was just always social tension. Guys came out of the ghetto. They were no longer part of the old community. They weren't accepted in the new community. And they had identity crises. And they were trying to carve something out for themselves. Anyway, there were a number of incidents. It would bubble up every 20 years. I mean, insane incidents of Jew hatred, because anti-Semitism as a word didn't exist in the middle of the 19th century. And this guy, Moses Hess, who was arguably the first German communist, introduced communism to Marx, or Marx to communism. In the 1860s, he sat down, he wrote a book, and he called it Roman Jerusalem. And he said, you know, until the Jews have their own nation of which they can be citizens in Palestine, where they come from, we cannot feel safe and secure, because a Frenchman with a French passport can live in London and know that he has his country. His country is France, and he can live and do business in London. Similarly, the Jews of Europe need to know that they have a country of which they are citizens, and it should be in Palestine. And we should start buying up land in Palestine. Now, this is 35 years before Theodor Herzl wrote essentially the same thing. Moses Hess is one of my ghosts, and Theodor Herzl claims never to have read him. I doubt that, actually. And it was this sense that, you know, we just need that one place of security, even then, in the middle of the 19th century, long before the Holocaust, so that we can be equals, you know, that we are citizens, and there's an equality, that we are citizens of a country. We're not constantly having to fight. And when Hess wrote, I mean, this was 1862, Germany was yet to be united, and in many parts of the German-speaking world, Jews were still, you know, second-class citizens living in a Jim Crow kind of discrimination.
Mm. Well, and we're reminded it was 100 years after the Civil War when American blacks received their rights. But we only have a couple minutes here. It's such a fascinating tale, but it becomes a very personal one for you as you trace your own roots.
Yeah, well, it did. I didn't intend that, but I mean, there are moments where I do link in, you know. I wrote about an incident, and I know that was the inciting incident for my great-grandfather to begin the long journey to America. And at the very end, I mean, I take the book only as far as April 1933 when the Nazis seize power. There's no need to take it all the way up to the horrors. I mean, let history do your foreshadowing for you so that you come through this record of really quite extraordinary stuff. I mean, world-changing stuff, and you know that we're about to enter a whole new phase of the game here, and it's not going to be a happy ending. But the same thing has happened in America. Freud's grandfather was a Hasidic rabbi. 3 generations, and Freud is one of the most important thinkers of the 20th century. three generations in America and look at how Jews who got off the boat with nothing have used the same kind of struggle to become part of a society, trying not to lose touch with something else. And it I have to say that it isn't just Jews. It's a universal thing, whether it's Mexican-Americans, African-Americans coming from Mississippi up north. It's a process, the process of emancipation.
Right. Michael Goldfarb telling us of the history that foreshadowed the history that we know of, the years leading up to the Nazis in Germany. His book is called Emancipation, How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. A terrific read. And again, you can read an excerpt at our website, hereandnow.org. Michael, who returns to your new home in London, thank you so much for coming in to spend some time with us.
My pleasure to see you again, Robin.
And still ahead today, after the latest news, The Prisoner, Old and New, the cult TV hit series. That's later. News is next, here and now. It's not a great time to be a young person looking for a job. The global economic downturn is taking a toll on high school and college grads as they try to enter the workforce. Well, they may find some lessons in Japan. In the 1990s, Japan's economy was in a slump, caused in part by a sharp plunge in the real estate market. Back then, jobs, good jobs, were hard to find in Japan. The BBC's Roland Burke profiles one man in his 30s who's never been able to land a permanent job.
Rush hour in Tokyo, and the train stations are full of purposeful men and women in dark suits, heading home after another long day at the office. But some have struggled to find a place in the world of work.
I'm 32. When I was in elementary school, Japan's bubble economy burst. When I was in high school, the ice age for recruitment started. I feel very much that I am part of a lost generation.
I'm having a coffee with Nori, that's his nickname, who graduated in 1998 during Japan's decade of stagnation. He couldn't find a permanent job, so got short-term contracts in IT. By 2007, over 3 million people in Japan between 24 and 35 were working as temps, more than double the number of 10 years earlier. And when the IT industry went into decline, Nori's work dried up.
Society's standards are set too high, especially for those of us who are unemployed. You always hear, don't be picky about jobs, just work harder. But they have to realize we live in a different world to earlier generations. You cannot compare what they did back when the economy was good to what we faced. There's no way we can dream or have hopes for the future. How can they say just work harder? It's part of the reason the young generation doesn't have hope.
We finish the coffee and head outside, past brightly lit amusement arcades and waiters trying to encourage customers into their restaurants. These are streets Nori got to know only too well.
The lowest point was when I lost a place to live. I lost my job. I had a problem with my family, my girlfriend, and my friends. I became depressed. I couldn't pay the rent, so I ran away.
When you lost your place to live, where did you end up?
I decided to reset everything and lose touch with everybody. I decided to leave by picking up stuff. If I got cold, I picked up an old blanket. I picked up food that had been thrown away. I didn't have money. I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have ID. Of course, I didn't have a mobile phone. That was the first to go. I came to a place like here, Ikebukuro. I picked up anything fast food restaurants threw away. That's how I lived.
Today you're wearing a suit and tie, so what's changed?
I went to see my family and I came to terms with them. This suit I'm wearing today was kept by my family from when I had a job. I just get cheap shirts.
Hey, now you're in training. Japan's economy is still looking pretty bad. Are you hopeful of getting a job?
First of all, you need to have experience doing a job you're looking for. If you don't have really good experience, you might as well have none at all. They'd rather take new graduates than people who have bad experience. There's really nothing available, whether it's temp work, full-time, part-time. There's really no job out there.
That report from the BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo. Well, just ahead, who's exactly growing the marijuana for medical marijuana in California? We'll look at some of the entrepreneurs. You're listening to Here and Now. More than a dozen states have laws allowing marijuana use by severely ill people, and the business is really booming in California, where marijuana is the state's most lucrative crop by a mile. By some estimates, the sales are about $15 billion this year alone, and in some cases, entire neighborhoods following local ordinances that allow the limited growing of marijuana for personal or medical use are doing just that. Federal officials say they won't go after pot-smoking patients or their sanctioned suppliers, but cities like Los Angeles are scrambling to deal with the exploding medical marijuana market. Some marijuana growers are positioning themselves to be the vineyards of the future. Well, journalist Susan Kuczynskas writes about this in Miller McCune magazine, which is published by the Miller McCune Center for Research, Media, and Public Policy. She joins us from the studios of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. Susan, welcome.
Thanks so much, Robin.
And you had us at the first sentence in your report. It reads, "Sarah's whole street reeks of pot." Who's Sarah? And tell us more about this street.
Okay. Sarah is a woman in her mid-50s who lives in Sonoma County, California. To look at her, you would think she's a typical suburban housewife, except that she is one of several people on her very block who is growing marijuana in her backyard.
And you can smell the pot everywhere. You can see it in some cases. And she tells you she doesn't know anyone in Sonoma County who isn't growing pot.
Well, I think she's exaggerating a little, but she does say, yeah, everybody's doing it. I mean, I ran into my neighbor at the hardware store buying grow lights.
And why is she doing it?
She needs extra money. Like many people in this economy, she's just looking to supplement her income a bit. She used to have her own business doing video, but with all the home video and the bad economy in general, her business has pretty much tanked in the last couple of years. And she found herself really struggling just to pay her property taxes.
And so this isn't making her rich, but she can, what, grow a couple pounds and make a few $1,000?
One plant typically will produce about 2 pounds of marijuana. She wouldn't talk specifics in terms of money, but my estimate is that she is hoping to make about $20,000 in a year, which is not that much money, but it's enough to make the difference for her.
And is it legal? You explain the complicated system in California where people can get prescriptions and they get licenses to grow the so-called medicine or medicinal marijuana, which is what it's called. So she got a prescription and now has a license, but how'd she get a prescription?
The law in California is that if you get a prescription from your doctor, you can sell, buy, or grow your own marijuana. Now, it's an open secret that it's extremely easy to get these prescriptions. Doctors who specialize in medical marijuana advertise in the alternative weeklies, cannabis magazines. They set up booths at rock concerts. So most people think that if you basically walk in the door of one of those docs and pay $150, you will walk out with a prescription.
Well, and an LA Times reporter did just that.
That's correct.
Well, then you've got Richard Lee, the president of Oaksterdam University. This is a school in California that teaches people how to grow and sell marijuana. So it's right out. Everything's just right out in the open. But simultaneously, you describe someone talking about a bust on their block of someone who was growing marijuana. So where does that come in?
You're correct, Robin. That's the big contradiction. People like Sarah feel that their local law enforcement people are not going to bust them. And in fact, President Obama, as you said recently, said that the feds will not bust people who are complying with state or local laws. In the case of the San Francisco bus, evidently there were guns, there were methamphetamines, there were other more criminal-type activities. In fact, one of the people I quote in the story who grows in San Francisco said, oh, yeah, of course, those people should be busted because they're criminals. So there's real dichotomy between people who feel I'm not a criminal even though I'm breaking federal law.
Well, and yet, you've got David Berger, the assistant city attorney for the city of Los Angeles, who said there are about 1,000 medical marijuana dispensaries. Now, these are the places where people who are growing the marijuana can sell it to the dispensaries who then turn around and sell it to the people with the prescriptions and the medical conditions. He says that not even 10% of them are selling pot for those legitimate medical reasons. So this, as you said, it's a huge open secret. Where do you think it's going?
I think it's going to legalization within the state of California. Assemblyman Tom Amiano introduced a bill in February that would legalize the possession, sale, and cultivation of marijuana, whether or not you have a medical need for it.
Well, that raises so many questions. If marijuana is completely legalized in California, what does that do to these people that you met who are really using it as a safety net to help them survive in a bad economy? And won't they get undermined when legitimate and huge corporate forces come in to sell it?
Some of these people hope to have more boutique operations, just as we have large international wine brands such as Gallo, but then we have your little boutique winery that maybe only makes a few hundred cases a year and charges a premium for it. They hope to be part of the locavore movement, the same people who are going to the farmer's market for their special apples that are grown by this special farmer may also, at the next booth over, have Sarah's wonderful special bud.
Well, and that's why you have Michael, who had a $150,000 a year job that he lost, and he now is turning himself into a farmer and growing plants. And as you say, carefully trying to establish himself as a serious businessman to the extent that he's openly paying for everything that has to do with marijuana with checks so that he has a trail?
Exactly.
Why?
He feels that if he can show that he can run a business professionally, he will be first in line to get a permit to do this legally.
Yeah. But then you have Luke, who is of the people you met, he's not someone who's growing marijuana to cash in on it. He desperately needs it. He has AIDS. He's in terrible pain. And really, you know, for him, it's a matter of how he lives. He can buy it at a dispensary, but that's $50 for an eighth of an ounce. And on his Social Security income, he can't afford it. So it's better for him to grow it.
This illustrates a problem with the way the current medical marijuana state of affairs is in California. The pot clubs are driving for higher and higher quality, more potency. But people who maybe are on low incomes and desperately need it medically are getting priced out of this. So if it were legal, perhaps there would be a lower end market for these people, just as it's very, very expensive to buy locally produced organic food right now. So maybe there could be a sort of Trader Joe's for marijuana.
A Trader Joe's for marijuana. That's Susan Kaczynskas, a journalist in California. Her story about the people who grow marijuana appears in the new issue of Miller McCune magazine. It's published by the Miller McCune Center for Research, Media, and Public Policy. Susan, thanks so much. Fascinating.
It was my pleasure, Robin.
You remember this television theme, a thunderclap opening yet another episode of the 1960s cult series The Prisoner, starring the late Patrick McGoohan as Number 6, the ex-secret agent whisked off to an island, spends the rest of the series trying to get back home. A precursor to Lost? Well, the AMC cable channel, home of Mad Men, has remade the program. It premieres Sunday, November 15th. Meanwhile, the original Prisoner is airing Friday nights on the Independent Film Channel and has just been released on DVD. And joining us to talk about The Prisoner, past and present, is here and now critic-at-large Ed Siegel, heretofore known as Number 7.
Oh, thank you, Robin. And we all know you're Number 1.
Ba-dum-bump. And we're throwing numbers, batting numbers about, because they did. I mean, that was one of the intriguing things about the series. They were numbers.
That's right. They don't have a name anymore.
And remind us more about the series. McGoohan starred in it, but also wrote, directed, and produced.
That's right. He was the one-man band. And he sold it to Lou Grade, a British producer, right after they had collaborated on Secret Agent, which was another spy series that they had sold to CBS.
So remind us more about the plot. He's resigned his position as a spy for some unnamed spy thing. And then what?
That's right. And then he's whisked away. He wakes up groggy in the village, which is this Stepford-like suburban sprawl of a place where every house is like every other house.
And where everyone is monitored by a series of number twos. Now, these are the nefarious leaders of the village. Their job is to get number six to reveal why he quit the spy business. Here's a little sound of what life is like in the village.
Program of early morning music, here are two announcements. The long-range weather forecast is that the fine spell will continue for at least another month.
Well, you know, we know it's in the 60s. It sounds very Rod Serling, Twilight Zone-ish. Like that same kind of feel?
There's nothing particularly supernatural about it, except for this giant ball that comes out of the ocean and drives everybody back into submission.
Oh, that.
But aside from that, it's just your average suburban place.
Okay. With these number twos trying to get number six to tell why he quit the spy business, I know you have some tape for us.
We're going to listen to his meeting with the most famous number two, played by Leo McKern, who you might remember from Rumpole of the Bailey and Help.
I am glad you're here. You really are a model.
But I don't run on clockwork.
You will, my dear chap. You will.
Do you think so?
Do you still think you can escape number six?
Well, I'm going to do better than that.
Oh?
Going to escape and come back.
Come back.
I mean, escape, come back, wipe this place off the face of the earth, obliterate it, and you with it.
There's a little bit of Kafka in there, a little bit of George Orwell, and a whole lot of Robin Hood, actually. We're in the middle of the 1960s, so number six becomes one of those great iconic figures of the time. He's fighting the establishment, he's railing against conformity, and he's engaging in all kinds of subversive activities. But, you know, he's also something of a conservative figure, a John Wayne rugged individualist, going it alone and really disdainful of any kind of groupthink of the left or the right.
Unlike me, many of you have accepted the situation of your imprisonment and will die here like rotten cabbages. The rest of you have gone over to the side of our keepers. I intend to discover who are the prisoners and who the warders.
Patrick McGoohan as number six, the original prisoner. So who gets to fill his shoes in the new prisoner?
It stars Jim Caviezel, who was the title character in Mel Gibson's infamous Passion of the Christ, and the great English actor Ian McKellen plays two. There aren't any numbers anymore. They're just six and two. And right. McKellen gets top billing, actually.
So they've dropped the word number,
right.
And they've seem to move number two up to the number one slot in billing, anyway. But is it a straight remake?
No, not really. It follows a very similar outline, but one that owes as much to Lost, as you said, as it does to The Prisoner. There's an emphasis on flashbacks, as in Lost, and depressive characters and equally depressive camera work. In some scenes, there are these twin towers in the distance that kind of remind you of the World Trade Center. So it's all very surreal in a way. Here's Caviezel, the plain-spoken mumbly six, he's learning the ways of the village here from McKellen.
The village is not all that there is.
What is it you're suggesting, six? A hole in the sky? Aliens landing secretly in the night? A mysterious road that leads beyond? A magic gateway, perhaps? Some portal leading into Never Never Land? Take a look outside, six. People going about their lives, strolling in the sun, sitting together in the park, or anywhere where they might choose to sit together. They take a scooter ride, go dancing, enjoy a beer in the cafe while they gaze about the village. Contented.
So, Ed Siegel, how else is the new Prisoner TV series different from the old one from the 60s?
In a way, it's kind of Gallagher's reinterpretation of the old series. You know, TV had never really seen anything like this before, and it reflected some of the surrealistic tone of the 60s.
We mentioned the big ball that kind of floated
right
by and kept people in line. Yep.
Right. And Six finally does break out at the end of the series, and he returns home to London. And just as he's going in the door of his old place, it clangs in back of him as if he's still a prisoner there. And so did he escape or didn't he? Gallagher kind of puts his stamp on some of the questions that the original asked.
And do you like his answers?
I can't say that I really do, Robin. No. It's, Caviezel just doesn't have McGoohan's charisma. Listen to Caviezel's pronouncement of the series' famous declaration and compare it with Patrick McGoohan's.
I will find a way to escape! Dear me! I am not a number! I'm a free man!
I am not a number. I am a free man!
Well, and what are you saying? I mean, the more modern version seems a little overwrought.
And also, you know, in the original, it was really a kind of child of the 60s. We have this hero who stop at nothing to be free. And in the new one, the village seems less sinister, less of a gulag. There's less at stake. That's why the original version was really iconic and why the new one is kind of just of passing interest.
Well, but if it's of passing interest to you, The New Prisoner airs November 15th on the AMC cable channel. And the original is running now on the Independent Film Channel, as Ed said. It's also available on DVD in a very attractive-looking box set. Mm. Ed Siegel here, and now critic at large. And Ed, for those listeners for whom none of this is familiar, let's go out with something that might be. This is the theme song from Patrick McGoohan's first series. We mentioned the Secret Agent series that he was in. And the theme song has the line that may have inspired him to make The Prisoner. We'll hear it in a different way now. They've given you a number, but taken away your name. Ed, number 7. Thank you.
How many times do I have to say, I am not a number, I'm a free man?
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number and taken away your name.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Secret agent man.
PRI, Public Radio International.